We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by surely a familiar voice to almost all of you, and that would be Janice Dean. Janice, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're out with such a lovely new book, and lovely, it's physically lovely. The cover is beautiful. The stories are beautiful. It's called I Am the Storm, Inspiring Stories of People Who Fight Against Overwhelming Odds. Janice, why did you want to tell these stories?
It started off as a book about my fight with Andrew Cuomo, to be honest with you. A number of people said, you know, this, what you're doing right now with the nursing homes, for people who aren't familiar, in 2020, at the height of the worst of the pandemic, our governor, disgraced Governor Cuomo, was putting thousands of COVID positive patients into nursing homes. And my husband, his mom and his dad were in separate elder care facilities, and we didn't have them in there for very long. His dad was in a nursing rehab center. He was not in great shape, and we were trying to get him in better health to join his wife, Dee, at an assisted living residence close to our house. It was planned. You know, Dee had a say in where she was going to live. They had lived in the same four-story walk-up in Brooklyn for almost 60 years of their life. They were having health issues, having trouble going up and down the stairs. So this was a planned event that we were doing with their blessing. And we were just trying to get his dad into better shape to join Dee at the assisted living residence. And then COVID crashed into our lives. We hadn't even packed up their apartment. So what I was seeing very little of is the coverage of COVID in nursing homes, and finding out that our governor had an order to put sick patients into elder care facilities for 46 days straight. And as it turned out, there were 9,000 sick patients being put into their nursing home facilities. So when I saw this, I thought to myself, why weren't we notified of this decision? And, you know, I believed our family members were directly put into harm's way by our government. So because I have a platform, I started to speak out about it. And I know the folks at Federalist, this was a story for you, but it wasn't getting a lot of traction on some of the mainstream media, television broadcasts, radio broadcasts, print. So I thought this was an important story to cover because both of my family members died in their assisted living and nursing homes. So this was a big story for me to follow. It was a big story for months where I was advocating on behalf of thousands of families here in New York. I was getting pushback by the Cuomo administration. I was getting people telling me, you know, be careful of this man, you know, watch your back. So long story long, I guess, people said, you know, you should write about this fight because I was up against a really powerful politician that was being whispered as perhaps a presidential candidate. So now we know that he had to resign. There were other things in the works in terms of his abuse with young women on his staff. But I really believe that the nursing home story should have been a bigger story. I believe it was criminal, and I'm still, advocating on behalf of the thousands of families. So it started off as writing that chapter of what happened in our family's life. And as I was doing that, I thought to myself, what fuels this desire to find out and to try to do better for others? You know, going up against a Goliath like Andrew Cuomo and his, dynasty family. What fuels the desire to do something like that when the odds are against me being able to, do anything about it, right? And as I was writing that chapter, I started finding people kind of doing the same thing, that despite the odds, they were still trying to go up against a big force, whether that be, government, whether that be a bully, whether that be the opioid crisis. So these people really trying to do something for the betterment of others, despite the incredible challenge that they face.
And yeah, there's some really fascinating stuff in here. One line absolutely gripped me, right? I think this is right in the beginning. It might even be in the introduction. You write, "Had I not had the challenge of risking my career to tell the truth about a very powerful boss, I didn't think I would have had the courage to stand up to a Cuomo." And you're referring to all of the allegations against Roger Ailes that toppled Roger Ailes and really changed Fox News and was a catalyst for the Me Too movement, even though people don't always give you guys the credit for being such a huge part of that as you were. Can you talk a little bit about that in your own motivations? And then if you saw similar patterns in other people that you talked to, you know, is there a catalyst in their life? Is there something that when people take on big odds, you can look back and say, oh, okay, so that's sort of, this was part of a plan.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point. And as I mentioned in the book, I don't know that I would have had the courage to stand up to Andrew Cuomo had I not had other moments in my life where I either walked away, which is what I did. When I first moved to New York, I worked for Don Imus, one of the biggest broadcasters in American broadcasting. He was not a nice man. And instead of standing up to him, I decided it was better for me just to leave that job. But all of these kinds of, you know, puzzle pieces in our lives that we put together afterwards, you know, you always see that kind of, well, I did that and now I'm doing this. You know, I think of them as storms that come through our life and kind of disrupt things, but also gives us a chance to build upon our own foundation to be stronger, right? So when I came to Fox News, and I've been here for 20 years now, I had issues with Roger. Roger did harass me, but at the time, you know, he wasn't the only one that had harassed me throughout my career, unfortunately. You know, like, these are the things that some women have to deal with, unfortunately, not just mutually exclusive in the broadcast community, but in a lot of workplaces. And I just kind of maneuvered that and dodged questions and laughed it off and really didn't think much of it. I was able to have a productive career and I was able to navigate myself away from that situation or situations. But when I found out that it was people, and when Gretchen Carlson launched her lawsuit against him, it was a moment where you either decide to make a difference or to do nothing. And it was easier for us to maybe do nothing. But at the time, I felt that it was really important that if this had happened to somebody else and it had happened to me years prior, then maybe it was still happening. And, you know, that was a really, really difficult time. I did not think that he was going to leave. I really thought that, you know, when I spoke up to the lawyers that were investigating him, that it would probably get back to him and I would be fired and no longer work in this industry. But it was a decision that I made with my husband, and I knew other women that had gone through the same thing. And it was an important moment to stand up, even within a company that I really loved. And love to work with and love to work for. And all these years later, you know, there were massive changes that happened here. You know, I now feel very safe in my work environment, whereas when I first worked here, I did not. And so that's one of those moments where I did stand up, even though I had everything to lose. Mm. So standing up to Cuomo on behalf of my family, I had already had that experience of being very fearful that this was going to, you know, maybe ruin my life, ruin my career. But I had the fortitude and I had the truth on my side. And I think if you have truth on your side, that will always prevail.
It's another really interesting thing about your story is that I think when people work in media, you get all kinds of insight into the way the sort of sausage is made, you know, how things leak and how government officials do things behind closed doors and all of that. And your story throughout COVID, throughout the Cuomo, everything that happened, all the controversies that happened late in his term in the governor's mansion up in New York, you really had an inside look. You've talked to several of the women who were involved in that, Charlotte Bennett, Lindsay Boylan, and their stories are in the book as well. Do you feel like you walked away from all of this learning or having your perspective changed on how our government and our media function? I mean, obviously, you've had an up close and personal view to this as somebody in media for a very long time. But these two things in particular, from COVID and the sexual harassment and abuse allegations, the way the media handled them, do you feel like your perspective was changed at all as you watched this happen?
Mm. It's tough. You know, when I talked to Lindsay and when I talked to Charlotte, I felt a sisterhood because I had gone through something like that. And I think they trusted me because I understood what they were going through. And we were all going up against an abusive person, right? A bully. And I had been through something like that. The problem that we all faced is getting our story out there because he was so loved and revered. I mean, you have to go back and look at how Andrew Cuomo was treated by other media. I had people in New York media tell me that he was going nowhere. They called him the Terminator. Like he was feared and revered. And so that was really tough going up against something like that. You know, he has been in the governor's mansion for decades, you know, starting with his own dad. And really his dad was very beloved figure here in New York, but he was well known as a bully. I would say the hardest thing we all faced was going up against, you know, big media, the New York Times, all of the morning news channels that had Andrew Cuomo on and would never ask him about some of the questions that he should have been asked at the height of the pandemic, right? I mean, New York was one of the worst prepared cities and states during the pandemic in terms of PPE, in terms of, you know, what doctors and nurses and nursing homes and hospitals had to protect themselves. He, you know, really ruled with an iron fist here. You know, they had pandemic plans in place and he decided to say, no, I'm the one that decides what every community, city, county does instead of what they had all planned before the pandemic. And so we had to go up against, you know, a tremendous Goliath. And it was rewarding when we finally saw some of those media that never dared ask him questions, finally having to cover these stories of abuse and bullying and corruption and what I believe criminality during the pandemic.
And that's, you have a great line in here. You say one of the things with people like Andrew Cuomo is that he will always believe he is the innocent one. Can mm-hmm. you tell us more about that? I thought it was such an interesting line.
Well, I think it's a personality disorder that he has. I believe he truly is a narcissist and he can never do wrong. Like during the pandemic, he blamed every single person except himself, you know, God, Mother Nature, the New York Post, Fox News. He blamed the women for their own, you know, doing of it was their fault, right? It was being an Italian that he decided to lay his hands on them. It's really, I don't think he can ever apologize or have any accountability in his own mind. He, you know, he's still trying to this day make a comeback. I still think at some point he can get back into government in his own mind, right? So that's just a personality disorder that he has. It's hard to get through to somebody like that. I think if he didn't have that kind of narcissistic personality, then he would have done something like reached out to families or apologized or done some of the work that he should have done, you know, decades ago in how to treat employees and how to treat women.
Hey, listeners, if you're like me and enjoy diving into the week's top stories in U.S. politics mixed with humor and hot takes, you need to subscribe to the Decaf podcast right now. Give it 30 minutes of your time as hosts Mark and Taylor discuss how much influence Trump really has in the Republican Party heading into 2024, plus all things sports and pop culture. Whether you're a politico or just someone who wants to impress your friends, you won't want to miss it. Subscribe to Decaf on Apple and Spotify today. Could you tell us about Maureen Flavin, another great story in the book?
Yes, Maureen Flavin Sweeney. So I start the book with, the book is called I Am the Storm, and this story is actually one of the reasons I wrote the book, not only because of the Cuomo story, but I had heard about her story a couple of years ago. And many folks in meteorology know the story of D-Day and how the weather played a huge role in the success of that operation. It was supposed to go forward on June 5th, 1944. There was a storm in the forecast that was well known. But the part that wasn't well known is there was an area of high pressure that was going to come in for a very short period of time and give a window of opportunity for the Allied forces, to invade. And Germany had no idea about that area of high pressure that would move in, so much so that, you know, one of the leaders decided to go home to his wife, and it was her birthday party, you know, so they were completely caught off guard. And one of the reasons is because the U.S. Had a better forecast. And Eisenhower, years after the D-Day invasion, I believe, said to John F. Kennedy, John F. Kennedy asked him, why was D-Day such a success for the Americans? And he said, well, because we had the best meteorologists. But what we didn't know about that is a woman named Maureen Flavin, soon to be Sweeney because she got married, was doing the forecast. She was getting all of the forecast information from a very remote lighthouse in Ireland. And, you know, as the Allied invasion was being planned, you know, leading up to that, she was getting the forecast information and having to deliver it every hour on the hour. And she didn't know why she was getting these phone calls to get the information of the weather forecast, because this remote lighthouse was one of the places where they were getting all of the, you know, the incoming forecast details. And she was the one that took the information down and, you know, gave it to that. All of this information that went to the meteorologist that made the decision to go in on June 6th and change the world, change history. So she really didn't know at the time what her, you know, forecasting details was doing and where it was going and what it would eventually lead to. And that's why I thought it was so important to add this story, because even though she didn't know the Goliath that she was up against, she changed history by being so diligent with her forecast details and giving, you know, giving the best forecast that she could that led to this incredible invasion that changed the world. And it was important to put this in the book because during the height of what I was trying to do with Andrew Cuomo and my family that died during the pandemic was I was being made fun of for my profession. The Cuomo administration was, you know, saying, oh, Janice Dean, you know, she doesn't, you know, I forget what the wording was, but it was something to the effect of she's not a reliable source on anything except maybe the weather. Mm. And so I thought it was important to put that story in because that young woman, you know, was a forecaster, a weather forecaster that changed the trajectory of a war. And that is so important. And I hope, you know, her whole story should be a movie, how, you know, her diligent forecasting really changed our whole world and our lives as we know it. So I start the book with that story and I end the book with the interview with her son, Vincent.
It was so smart. It's such a great decision to weave it throughout the book because it's just a truly incredible story that speaks to so much of what you write about. How did you go about curating the stories that you wanted in the book? I mean, I know a lot of them are from personal relationships and extended personal relationships. How did you decide, you know, I want this to be in the book, or I need to tell this person's story?
It's a good question. You know, I had kind of a list of people that I really wanted to talk to. There's a lot of pandemic heroes in there. You know, Chef Gruhl, who I'm sure, you know, your viewers and listeners and readers know of him, the fight that he went up against as a restaurant owner in California against Gavin Newsom's lockdown rules. He really is an incredible hero because, you know, people would say to him, well, you're just a chef. You're just a guy who makes food. How do you know about, you know, what's safe when it comes to the pandemic and opening a restaurant when you're told not to? So, you know, there are several stories about the pandemic. I talked to Jennifer Say. I started off talking to her about her gymnastics career because she was somebody who was a whistleblower on the abuse in gymnastics from the very beginning of her career. And, you know, was kind of blacklisted when she came out and said, you know what, the gymnastics community is rampant with abuse. And she was a champion of all the gymnasts that came forward about Larry Nassar, the doctor, the gymnastics doctor who abused hundreds of women over the years. But she also was a champion again during the pandemic when it came to school closures. So I talked to her not only about gymnastics, but I came back again when she was doing all her advocacy about keeping the schools open during the pandemic. You know, the nurse, Arlene Simmons, who came to New York when we knew nothing about the virus. She was a travel nurse that came to New York to help other nurses who were getting sick. Her story and the fact that the money that she got from nursing here in New York during the pandemic, she's helping youth with a youth center that she opened up. So these are all stories that kind of came my way. I really, really believe, you know, fate had a lot to do with this. You know, I would find one person and I'd be able to get, you know, into contact with them. And then that would lead me to another person. One of the stories that really touched my heart and I think about a lot is our friend Ray Pfeiffer, a firefighter. My husband's a firefighter, worked with Ray a couple of decades ago, you know, during 9/11. Ray got 9/11 related cancer and was one of the whistleblowers, you know, during his illness to say, we need to take care of our first responders because they're dying of 9/11 related illness. I mean, here's a guy who was dying of cancer and went to Washington, D.C. in his wheelchair to get lawmakers to try to pass the Zadroga bill to help his fellow firefighters. So, you know, everyone touched my life. And, you know, even at the end, when I talk about interviewing Vincent, the son of Maureen Sweeney, who helped with the D-Day forecast, he told me that he did the interview because his sister lives in upstate New York and she works at a nursing home, Emily,
wow,
and how she knew my story. So I feel like this book was meant to be put out in the universe, and all of these stories are so special and have, you know, special threads that go throughout the book.
That's you get goosebumps hearing that. It was incredible. I actually wanted to ask you about our friends Asra Namani and Jennifer Say, who are in the book, because their stories speak to kind of cancel culture. I mean, their stories are much bigger than cancel culture and span, you know, decades, not just the last couple of years. But Janice, as we've seen that sort of hit the fever pitch, this idea that people who are talking or just saying, you know, totally normal things like Jen did during the pandemic about kids in schools, things that have aged very, very well, or what Asra has said, for instance, about kids in schools. This was stuff that threatened their careers, that threatened their families, that threatened everything. I mean, it threatened their lives. What do you think it is about that time in, maybe some people still think we're in it, we're still in that sort of moment of cancel culture. Can you speak to how you saw people weather those storms, people who were facing unjust sort of social persecution, professional persecution, how they, like Asra and Jen, pushed through those circumstances?
Well, I think if you read their stories, they talk about their life before, you know, the advocacy, and you can kind of see the storms that they had in their lives before they got to this moment that gave them the courage, that gave them the fortitude to stand up, even despite all of the, you know, the nastiness that they got. You know, Jen lost her job with Levi's, a place that she was on, you know, she was there for decades, and they championed her when she was an advocate for gymnasts. But when she stood up and said, we need to keep the schools open for our kids, you know, that really put a black mark on her career. Even though what she said now is the truth, you know, we should have kept our schools open. I think the pandemic brought out a lot of mama bears in us. And that's, you know, that's Astra right there, right? The mama bear movement. She was the one who also stood up and said, you know, we're not going to take this. Our children deserve to be in schools, and our children deserve to be recognized for how well they do in schools with the merit programs, right? The ones that some schools are trying to get rid of. So I think if you look at the trajectory of their lives and their careers, they've kind of always been people who stand up for the right reasons. But the pandemic kind of made us all a little bit stir crazy in our own homes. And maybe that's what stirred us up too, because I was at home seeing my youngest on the Zoom calls during trying to do schoolwork. And he was going crazy. He was having meltdowns. So us as moms and dads, we were seeing this in our own homes and getting so frustrated by it. And, you know, I decided to enroll my kids into Catholic schools because the Catholic schools were still up and running. But I was lucky that I could do that. We're supposed to take care of our kids that, you know, can't afford private schools, Catholic schools, but we failed them. We failed them. But I think the pandemic really made us, you know, shake us up a lot, because we were told to stay inside and, you know, don't do this and don't do that. And I think that made a lot of us, you know, angrier than we normally would be.
That really tees up one of the big questions I wanted to ask you very well, which is the fact that the Cuomo brothers, well, I mean, you can debate whether or not Chris Cuomo was taken down. I think it's probably fair to say he was. He lost his very cushy job at CNN, mm-hmm. although he is still working in media, unfortunately. But the reality that actually happened, when, you know, you had people saying to you personally, like, they're a machine, they're not going anywhere, just watch your back, because they're, you know, it's impossible to take them down. They'll take you down before they go down. But the fact that they actually were taken down, and that there has been some semblance of justice, whether or not it's enough, I think is very much an open question. I think you're right. There's major criminal questions. But the fact that they were taken down, does that say anything about progress that has been made in this country? Maybe it was the Me Too movement, maybe it was the pandemic. Is it a positive sign that we're continuing to go in a good direction, that they were both taken down, basically?
I hope so. But, you know, listen, like you said, they get back up again. and listen, I think that it's frustrating. I'm still frustrated. Chris Cuomo, I don't pay attention to as much, even though, you know, he was part of the problem putting his brother on night after night. That wasn't just him though. That was the leadership at CNN, which also toppled as well. Jeff Zucker, you know, he's gone, but he's coming back again too. Of course, I find that a lot of these men do help each other out. You know, I feel like they go away for a little bit and then they come back in some capacity. Whereas I feel like if it was a woman that this happened to, that wouldn't be the case. They'd have a harder time making it come back. But listen, I'm not going to say that there wasn't some semblance of relief seeing Andrew Cuomo, you know, resign on television, something that I never thought he was going to do. But I still think he needs to be, you know, there needs to be accountability, and I'm still hopeful that's going to happen. You know, there are things that we're doing behind the scenes that you don't see me, you know, on the Fox and Friends, you know, on Fox and Friends every day saying, here's what I'm doing today. This is the rally I'm going to, this is the lawyer I'm meeting with. But we're going to continue to advocate for, you know, what happened to the elderly in nursing homes. It wasn't just New York. It was other states that did the same thing, put this order in to put sick patients into nursing homes. I believe that was a criminal act. I think they took a civic right away, the right to life for our loved ones. And there needs to be, you know, an after action review, not only of nursing homes, but the whole pandemic, Emily. You know, where did the virus come from? We need to find out the mistakes that were made, not only by, you know, governors, but the federal government. Because if we don't have that, if we don't have some kind of, you know, commission or hearings, this is going to happen again. We can't just shove all of this under the carpet. This was a major event that happened in our lives across the world. And we have to revisit the mistakes that were made. You know, otherwise we don't learn anything.
One final question, Janice, and that would just be, what's your advice? Obviously, there's a lot of it in the book, but what is your advice for people who feel like they're facing tough odds right now? Lessons that you've learned over the last several years in particular, is there any advice that you can share for people who may be confronting difficult odds right now?
You know, the theme of the book, when I talk to each of the wonderful folks in every chapter, it's finding others, right? It's finding other people going through the same type of situation. So, you know, for me, I found other families whose loved ones were in nursing homes and had, you know, their lives taken away. For, you know, the mom of the daughter who went through, you know, opioid addiction. She found other families that went through similar circumstances. I think if you find like-minded people or people who are going through the same type of challenges, you know, it all not only gives you strength in numbers, but also it gives you that courage to keep going, right? And as I mentioned, truth, you know, the truth is on our side. The angels are on our side. I feel like, you know, one truth can topple thousands of lies, right? And I think that that's the main takeaway, is that if you have a righteous cause, you're going to find people that stand up with you.
Mm. Janice Dean, author of the new book, I Am the Storm. It's out on January 17th. Make sure to pick up a copy. Congratulations on the book, Janice, and thank you so much for joining us.
Listen, thank you for, you know, helping me spread the word as well. I mean, I'm very grateful to your reporting and the people with the Federalist, because if it weren't for you, honestly, I do think that they would have tried to silence us. So thank you.
Oh, absolutely. And we're so grateful to all the people, yourself included, who were willing to say tough things and tell tough truths when it was completely necessary. And that's a huge theme of this book. So Janice, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Emily.
You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
You got me right.